I loved your presentation, Neil.
Thanks, bro.
Hanging on your every word, really resonating with what you brought to us today.
Thank you.
Awesome. I will let you guys go.
Let's do it.
And I will bow out of here so that I can continue to share links. And you guys have yourself a wonderful discussion. And if any questions come up, I'll pop them into the questions.
Thanks, Omar. All right, Paul, all right. I'm going to go ahead and do a little bio before we get into this, okay? And I got to say that I was reading your – maybe I should say this later, after your bio. I'll do this after. We'll start with your bio. Okay, everybody. So I'm extremely excited to be introducing Paul Anthony Wallace today and a little bit about him. He's the author of the international bestseller Escaping from Eden. He's a popular speaker, researcher, and author of books on spirituality, mysticism. As a senior churchman, he served as a church doctor, a trainer of pastors, and archdeacon in the Anglican Church in Australia. Today's work probes the world's mythology and ancestral narratives for the insight into human origins, potential, human potential, and our place in the cosmos. Escaping from Eden was hailed by George Norrie as this generation's chariot of the gods. His latest book, The Scars of Eden, is endorsed by Eric von Daniken. Paul also hosts the Paul Wallace channel on YouTube and co-hosts the Fifth Kind TV in partnership with Gaia TV. And today I was reading up on Paul and skimming through the book, read actually probably a good half of it, and I still have some to go. And in that, I saw so many dots are being connected. Paul connects a lot of dots, and he does what I enjoy doing as well, which is connecting our true ancient history with what is going on in modern times and seeing if there's any parallels, and especially the biblical connection that you had. So I need to say before, you know, you officially come on here, that me reading your book today actually inspired me and drove me to have so much passion for my presentation. So I was excited to do that because I saw so many similarities in what we were communicating about. So Paul, I just want to say I'm honored to be here with you. Thank you for being on the show today. And welcome. Oh, I think you're muted.
How's that? Is that better?
There we go.
All right. I was saying the feeling is mutual. I think it's a wonderful thing when we can meet like this and we just, we get each other fired up. Our juices are flowing. Yes. And we really, there's a lot of synergy when you compare thoughts and realize, hey, yes, I am on the right track.
Yeah.
Because a lot of these a lot of the time we spend in joining the dots, piecing the picture together, is time alone. But you really need the fellowship of fellow explorers to have that courage to think, no, actually, I really am onto something here, and to have that appetite and energy to keep going.
Yeah, doing events like this really creates the inspiration in order for us to do more. You know, just having this interaction makes me want to create more content and connect with people about this information. And, you know, you've created, you've had one book that I believe that's already come out, and then you have this new book that's coming out right now, The Scars of Eden. Why don't you start off by telling us, because I'm curious as well, because I kind of skimmed over your history part to get to the content of your book. So why don't you tell us about your history and kind of how you got into this whole thing?
Yeah, my way into the subject might surprise some people because it was from out of the world of Christian ministry. And you mentioned briefly there, I was in Christian ministry as a kind of a church doctor for 33 years. I was an archdeacon for the Anglican Church in Australia, and I trained pastors in the principles of handling ancient texts, the Bible in particular. And through all that 33 years, I was doing business with the Bible as a preacher, as a teacher, as a lecturer. And anyone who reads the Bible regularly or preaches from it will, every so often, fairly frequently, come across anomalies in the text that they think, hold on, that, what is that? That doesn't quite make sense. What kind of story is this? This doesn't make sense morally. There's something else going on here. And if you're the average kind of preacher like myself, you'll say, I've got to get back and drill down into that, find out what's really going on. But then the world of work is so busy, you never get back to it. You just have these question marks swirling around for when you have the time. And Escaping from Eden really begins in a moment when I did have the time, an ultimate frisbee injury it is in the book, although that's a little bit of a code for a number of times when the universe has given me some time. And I took the time in my my shipping crate cabin to sit down with the texts, realize there's another story hidden in plain sight here. It's probably a translation issue because I'm a linguist as well. That's my original background at university, linguistics and languages, and tackle some translation questions. And that was really the white rabbit that took me down the rabbit hole. And once I did some translation work, I realized there is another story hidden in plain sight in those texts, and it is a story of ancient ET contact, a story in which our ancestors were visited, colonized, and adapted by visitors from other parts of the cosmos, and that is the story that's been modified, airbrushed over. And it was a real red pill moment for me when I read those writings from the Bible alongside the Mesopotamian corpus, the Sumerian, Babylonian, Akkadian, and Assyrian stories. Yeah. And it becomes very clear very quickly that the biblical stories are a summary of those. Mm. And those stories are far clearer that they're not talking about God. They are talking about ET beings who came, colonized the planet, and genetically modified our ancestors. So that was the beginning of my journey. And in Escaping from Eden, I share some of that journey because I want people to be able to get from zero awareness, even zero interest in the topic, but by the end of Escaping from Eden, think, oh, there's actually something really solid here that I can give some attention to. So the book traces that journey, and it finds parallels in our ancestral narratives all around the world, and then finds corroboration in contemporary science and contemporary research that really supports the explanation our ancestors gave of who we are, what we're capable of, and what our longer story really is. But there's another reason it was rattling around in my head and that I was thinking I've got to tackle this. And that was because way, way back when I was 11 years old, I first encountered the work of Erich von Däniken. And I felt that he had correctly identified a gap in our ability to explain ourselves. Because as a boy, I went to a Church of England school. And so I was getting the dual explanation of our origins, the one from Orthodox Christianity and the one from contemporary science. And if I look at human beings, I think, well, the religious answer to who we are doesn't quite account for how come it's so obvious that we're a kind of animal. You know, if we're a special and unique creation, how come it's obvious that we're really an animal? And when I go to the scientific explanation, how are we at the top of the tree here? Because it's only because of our higher consciousness and our higher intelligence leading to technology that means that we can be the alpha species on the planet. But with living in the wild without our technology, we're not very well adapted here. I mean, some people can do it. Bear Grylls can do it. But if I was left in the wild on my own without any technology, can't light a fire or anything, you know, after 3 days, three nights, I'd be ill, deceased, or in hospital. How come all the animals can live here quite happily and there's something about us that doesn't quite fit? Well, Erich von Däniken had identified that gap in our ability to explain and asked some questions that had never quite got answered for me. And so it had always been a question in my mind. What is the truth of our origins and how does that relate to the stories that are told by our world religions? And I found a whole new world opened up the moment I sat down and did some translation work.
Wow. So you, at age 11, you said you came across Erich von Däniken's work, right? And the connection. Then you grew up and you became, you know, involved in the church. Did you have that awareness or were you kind of following, let's just say, you know, non-conventional Christians and conventional, were you following down a conventional route that really didn't include that? And then you started kind of questioning it later, but you had an influence earlier in childhood and it wasn't a part of it anymore? Or, you know, how did that evolve for you? And did you still claim to be Do you still call yourself a Christian now? Did it shift your religious beliefs?
Yes. Wow. Lots of questions. let me see if I can remember them all. In a funny way, reading Eric von Däniken led me to becoming a Christian because it got me asking some big questions. Mm-hmm. And I discovered Jesus because I had friends at school who were believers. And the moment I was able to realize that there is a difference between the credibility of Jesus as a figure and as a teacher and the credibility of religious institutions, once I'd separated those two out, it was easy for me to say, well, actually, I find Jesus quite a compelling person and his teaching makes a lot of sense to me. So in that way, when I became a Christian, not someone who was into churchianity. And I could always see a clear blue water between what I was seeing in the Gospels and the tradition that's emerged in his name. And that would be true of a lot of pastors. A lot of pastors are very interested in Jesus, and they can see that what's emerging in his name is not the same. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of pastors would be like myself, going at this topic with constant question marks. Now, I had specific question marks about our place in the cosmos. And I remember when I was a very new believer being very excited when I found a verse in the Gospel of John that I reckoned pointed to the possibility of a populated universe. And I took it to my peers at school and I said, hey, look, I think Jesus is talking about aliens here. And their reply was essentially to say, Paul, look, now you're a Christian, you need to forget about all that cosmic stuff, okay? Mm-hmm. But I didn't forget about it. And those questions have journeyed with me in the time since. Mm-hmm. And in the research I've done in recent years, yes, I think it's reframed a lot of my beliefs. I'm still a great fan of Jesus. My vision of God is completely expanded through getting into the territory of populated universe, E.T. Hand in our origins as a species. It brings me to a far more cosmic vision than ever I had before. And when I say cosmic vision, that's of the universe, but that's of humanity as well. My sense of connection with God and with humanity has been completely enhanced for me personally by these explorations into ET territory, paleo contact, and listening with a fresh ear to the testimony of our ancestors carried in folklore and mythology all around the world. Because my old way of translating the Bible, what you see in conventional translations, where the Elohim stories are told as God stories, mm-hmm. kind of pitches the Bible over and against all other world mythologies as if to say, oh, mm-hmm. forget all that. This is the truth.
Yeah.
I found once I'd done a bit of translation, no, these ancestral narratives all overlap and confirm each other, and sometimes in the most surprising detail. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So where does God come into all this? If you see ETs in the Bible, are these ETs higher dimensional messengers of a source because they have maybe a frequency that is out of this world where they have this knowledge? Or is even God even spoke about in the Old Testament, let's say, or is this all just a story of the drama of extraterrestrials? What are your, is your belief on that?
Yes, I think, there's so much going on in the Hebrew scriptures, it's difficult to give a really snap answer. But if I had to give a snap answer, I'd say that wherever you see Yahweh as an active character in the Hebrew scriptures, you are looking at an extraterrestrial being among many.
Yes.
And the old word is Elohim, which means the powerful ones. And Yahweh is one of those powerful ones. So that then raises the question, well, does God, the source of the universe, if we have that higher concept, does that God appear in the Hebrew scriptures? And yes, I think so. I think when you get to the later prophets, they have that more cosmic vision.
Right.
When you get into Christianity, you go to the Apostle Paul, and he actually defines what he means by the word God when he's talking to a Greek audience in Athens. He says, by God, I mean the source of the cosmos and everything in it. And so very often these days, instead of using the word God, which is so laden with religious associations, I often try to speak instead of the source, understanding that there is a source to everything, yes, to the cosmos and everything in it. And Plato is a real linchpin for me in holding together all the topics that we've been looking at. Mm-hmm. In Forgery Unmasked, he has his finger on every pulse.
True.
And he had a belief in God. His understanding was that in the beginning was consciousness. Mm-hmm. And that that original consciousness is the source of the material universe. He said the material universe exists in order for the primordial consciousness to express itself and experience itself. And everything that's in the universe exists as an emanation of that consciousness, as a manifestation of it. So whether we're talking about humans, rocks, animals, Pleiadians, Lyrans, Syrians, we are all emanations of that source, and we're all participating in that source consciousness. Mm-hmm. Plato talks a great deal about that, and parts of it you read and you think you're reading quantum research. Parts of him you read, and it sounds like the beginning of the Gospels. He was able to pull together so much knowledge from 2,500 years ago, express it, synthesize it, and argue for it in a way that is logical, so that we can agree on things we all observe, and then he would apply logic to those things, and then he would reach these conclusions about consciousness and who we are.
Yeah, definitely. You also mentioned that you just said something about Apostle Paul, and that's from the quote that you have in your book about, I think it was about Jesus not saying to serve him, but Christianity became of service to Jesus, but he was not saying that in the first place. So, and I get what you're saying now, because yeah, there was drama that took place with these beings that we speak about in the Old Testament, but then there were messengers that were definitely divinely orchestrated. Right. So like that were giving these messages, and they were probably tapped into some sort of source. So did you have this belief of, like, you know, being of service to, what are we of service to if we're not of service to Jesus?
I think the word service and the word worship both have really been distorted by thousands of years of religious teaching and practice. When our ancestors were colonized by a more advanced species turning up, and the Sumerians talk about the Anunnaki and the Hebrew scriptures talk about the Elohim, our ancestors lived in a world where the people who governed were not human. Mm-hmm. And the people who governed had adapted us so we could be a useful workforce for them. And they experimented until they got a species that was willing to serve their superiors. Mm-hmm. The Popol Vuh, which is the Mayan explanation of human origins, is very frank in the language it uses. It says that those who engineer, that's what they call the Elohim, mm-hmm, had gone about some experiments, and the question they were answering was, can we produce avatars for ourselves to do the work for us and bring us our, yes, food? And so they do some experiments, and they come up with a species which is pretty good, physically quite able, but has no interest in serving superiors. I mean, can you imagine engineering a gorilla and then finding that it won't work for you and bring you your food? But they'd obviously done something like that. So they have another go. Early on, they produced something that wasn't intelligent enough to serve them, and then something that was too intelligent to serve them. And then they produced something that was us plus a bit of precognition, a bit of remote viewing. And they found they couldn't manage a species like that. How do you control and herd a species if it's gone precognition? It's not going to work. So Kukulkan, a.k.a. Kukumats, a.k.a. Quetzalcoatl, has a final job as the chief genetic engineer to dumb us down And so he comes up with a vapor, which when sprayed over human populations, diminishes our neurological abilities to what is normal today.
So they can we only
have glimpses. Well, you wonder, don't you? Glimpses of remote viewing, glimpses of precognition. But for the most part, limited to our five senses, we have to believe what we see or are told by authorities. And they found that useful. In the Sumerian stories, it's clear that the powerful ones, the sky people, felt that if they could frame our working for them in a religious sense, that would work better, because then we would count it as a virtue to serve them. And this hard wiring has served us very ill in all the aeons since. It makes us as a species very easy to manipulate and manage. Populations all around the world just seem to exist on the basis that the poor serve the rich, the powerless serve the powerful. And this is wired into us back from that time when we were engineered. And I actually find that the Apostle Paul and Jesus are unraveling that. They're totally reframing the idea of that kind of service. We should not be serving superiors. Jesus said, you have no superiors. You're all brothers and sisters. Call no one your leader. Call no one your teacher. You're all peers. And Jesus and Paul were very clear that the whole idea of serving God, we should reframe as serving one another. God doesn't need anything from us. God's the source of everything. And this is actually the sermon that Paul preached in Athens.
Right.
God doesn't need anything from us. What is good and when we are in tune with source is when we're loving each other, when we're in harmony, when we're serving one another. And I'm happy to use the word serve in that context. But the whole idea that you have tiers of importance where, you know, we commoners serve the elites, this is rubbish. This is not what we're here to do at all. And when we become more intelligent, more conscious, we begin to unravel that and get out of it. And I find a lot of that in Jesus's teaching and Paul's.
Yeah, the whole concept of having to serve something implies that life is not the way it should be, and you cannot correct the timeline, or you can't be living positively unless you're of service to someone else. But I feel that's not the case, that our experience here on earth is to experience and to give love and to receive love, but not to give away our power. Right. And that's
not to give away our power. Exactly. And unfortunately, religion thrives on people giving away their power. Even religions that are supposedly about equality and harmony. I mean, in Christianity, you've got the whole idea of the priesthood of all believers. And yet, organizationally, you still have congregation dependent on the pastor subject to the bishop subject to the archbishop, and we've refeudalized our society often through our religious structures.
Yeah, it's interesting because when you look at a lot of prophets, including the Buddha, and you read the scriptures, it's almost like they're telling you, do not follow me, do not create a religion after me, but we do it anyway. So it's almost like almost like it's in the human template to do it. You can't even judge it even because it's just the way it is. But now we can learn something different because we've, you know, obviously reaching a level of consciousness to shift that. But I wanted to mention, like, so you talked about how you connected the Christian text to the Sumerian scriptures, and you realized that many of the stories, like the Sumerian scriptures, seem to be the seed stories for many religions all over the world. And I love what you said there, because that's exactly how I got into it, where, you know, even though I was raised Hindu, I was born in England, and I celebrated Christmas every year, and most Indians in England celebrate Christmas and believe in Jesus even. So I read the Bible a couple times, and then when I woke up when I was 18, I compared it to the Sumerian scriptures and the Bible, and I came up with this one, it could be one thing or the other. Either this religion of Christianity is completely fake, or it came from something to do with star beings. Right. So it seems like you had that similar kind of trajectory. But in your book, you mentioned that there was actually extraterrestrials mentioned in a lot of ancient scriptures, and then there was commanded out over time. So maybe you can speak on a few of those cases and how that occurred.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, I will do that. And then I'd like to talk about some of the other ancestral narratives around the world that independently seem to remember the same things.
Yeah.
But yes, I mean, the moment you translate the word Elohim as the powerful ones, the Sumerian stories suddenly reveal themselves in the text of the Bible. And then you get to a moment, I mean, a very famous moment, for instance, the Ten Commandments. Moses is giving these Ten Commandments, and the first one says, you must have no other powerful ones other than me. Do not bow down to them. Do not even depict them. Serve only Yahweh. So right there in the Ten Commandments, you've got a forgetting that's being commanded, but an acknowledgement of a world with lots of powerful ones in it. And this is from a time when human colonies were governed over by these ET entities called Elohim. They're in competition with one another. They send their humans out to war against each other because they're in competition for hegemony, for resources. And here's the Ten Commandments saying, don't you work for those other ones. You work for Yahweh. And I don't want you even to remember that the other ones exist. Don't draw pictures of them, for goodness sake. So you've got that. Then the generation that follows, the next leader is Joshua. He puts out a call in the 24th chapter of his book, the book written to commemorate him. And he says, choose today who you're going to follow. You're going to follow and work for the powerful ones that your ancestors served in Mesopotamia, or the powerful ones the Egyptians served, or the powerful ones that the Amorites work for. As for me and my house, we're going to work for Yahweh. We're going to serve him. Again, there's an acknowledgement of a world that's populated with these Elohim, these powerful ones, and they are governing. Which are you going to work for? Work only for Yahweh. Now, scholars call that a henotheistic world. It's not monotheistic, a world where there's only one God. There are all these powerful beings in the mix. But the ET aspect of who they are is going to be airbrushed out bit by bit. And when we get to the 6th century BCE, the whole of the Hebrew scriptures, and there's a very broad scholarly consensus that this is the case, was edited together to present a single storyline, a God story about God the Almighty, whose name is Yahweh. And so there has to be a little bit of airbrushing of these earlier stories. The stories Abraham and Sarah carried with them, the Elohim stories, they're not God stories. They're stories about ETs. Let's retranslate that word as God. And, oh dear, there are some other texts where that word seems to indicate beings who are on the wrong side. Well, let's translate it as demons in those texts. And so there's this almost arbitrary selection of translating Elohim as God, demons, false gods, chieftains, landlords, and you pick which it is according to what's happening in the story. And for the most part, it worked, except for these anomalies you can still find. And so you get to Genesis 3, the story of the fall, and it makes no moral sense at all. You get to Genesis 11, a civilization has to be destroyed because they've infringed building codes. It makes no sense at all. Try explaining to a child, a God of love, genociding the whole human race except for one family because it changed his mind. The stories really become very distorted. You get to the story of Abraham being commanded to sacrifice, to kill his son Isaac, and then being told at the last minute, only joking. In Genesis 3, the story of the so-called fall, you've got God wanting to keep humans so unintelligent they don't even know they're naked. It becomes a nonsense through that translation in the 6th century BCE that turns stories of warring ET demographics, conflicting with each other over how to manage Project Earth. If you make all of those stories about God, you have a God who's fighting against himself, killing us in the process, confused, fails to anticipate things a child could anticipate. And that is why, right at the beginning of Christianity, there were significant church fathers saying, no, we don't accept that edit. We do not accept those as accurate stories of God, and we should not glue that onto the apostolic writings to make a Bible of Old Testament and New Testament. And there was a big debate about it. And unfortunately, the debate, in my opinion, went the wrong way. Right. And Christianity re-endorsed that edit, which had almost obscured the memory of our ET origins and produced a monstrous image of God in the process.
Wow. Yeah. And, you know, in your book, you speak about a lot to do with the Bible, but it really goes beyond that. Even you talk about hybridization program. You talk about a lot about hybridization program, a lot about people's experiences. And then also folklore, such as fairy folklore from Ireland and all that. I want to go into that right now, but I want to ask you one more question on the Bible first. How does the whole concept of the Council of Nicaea come into this?
The Council of Nicaea, people often throw stones at the Council of Nicaea in particular. And I think that may be because of the Dan Brown book, The Da Vinci Code. In actual fact, the throwing out of ET knowledge was a longer and more gradual process than that. So it began very early on when Marcion, one of these very important church fathers, was pronounced a heretic because he had named what was going on in those old texts. They're not about God, they're about something else, he said. So they made him a heretic, and he had a massive international following, so they were in effect all told to shut up if they wanted to be considered Christians. And then you get to 381 when Emperor Theodosius wades into a theological debate and settles it by imperial fiat. And in that moment, he sort of militarizes this orthodoxy that's narrowing down. So now, if you're not in this narrow orthodoxy, not only are you a heretic, but you're not a proper citizen, and you probably can't hold public office. And if you're a priest, you might find yourself executed. And if you wrote a book, it'll be burned. And it's in that period that you've got the Gnostic Gospels and other literature literally being buried to try and preserve it, because it's flying off the shelves of public libraries. They are being destroyed, anathematized. And so they were buried to preserve that knowledge for a later period. So the Council of Nicaea did some useful things in tidying up what Orthodox Christianity was going to be, but it was part of a whole process of going from a kaleidoscope of understanding and a kaleidoscope of theologies down to this narrow view, and everything outside it was now not Christianity. And that's why even today, just as Rodney was saying, you know, people look at ancient texts like the Corpus Hermetica, and they say, oh, well, that's black magic, that must be demonic, that can't be right, because it's not part of this narrow canon. But in the beginning, there was this kaleidoscope, and part of what I'm doing in The Scars of Eden in particular is saying, let's look at that kaleidoscope again, because there was knowledge that was lost that we need to recover, and that repeats in narratives all around the world that actually has information in it about our human potential and our place in the cosmos.
Right. So we can, honestly, I could ask you questions on the Bible forever, but let's transition into that now. You just said that there's, stories from all over the world. So could you share some of those with us?
Yeah. What I find really interesting is when you realize that different cultures at different times on different parts of the planet have found different metaphors and language to relay a visual memory. So for instance would be, starting in the Bible, in Genesis 1, it says that a ruach turns up over a planet Earth that's been devastated. It's flooded, it's shrouded in darkness, and the ruach turns up to terraform it. Now, it gets translated as the Spirit of God. It's actually a piece of technology. It's a craft, and it creates vortices of wind to clear the water from the high ground so that it can begin this process of rehabilitation. Now, the Sumerian stories of beginnings also begin in darkness and over the waters. The waters have to be separated, just like in the Bible, fresh water and salt water, and then land has to be cleared. And so we have the story of the four winds doing the work of creation in the Sumerian account, and the four winds have descended from the heavens to do their work. If you go to Cameroon, Nigeria, listen to the Edo people. They have the story of Osanabua, the powerful one above the waters, is what Osanabua is. Again, vortices of wind above the flood waters to clear the land and begin rehabilitation. You go to the Philippines, and there is a folklore there of Tagalog, the hawk, who hovers over the waters. It's so interesting. This hovering is mentioned in all those texts. It's in the Mesoamerican story, the Popol Vuh as well. Talks about the those who engineer turning up in the darkness, hovering over the waters, working out how to rehabilitate life on Earth. In the Philippines, it hovers like a hawk. It's called a hawk, and it creates vortices of wind to create the islands. So I find that interesting. Osanabua turns up on a chain. Tagalog is a hawk. A ruach is a craft that creates winds. In the Sumerian, it's just winds that appear from out of the heavens. And because we've got different metaphor, different language, to me that says this is not a book that has gone around the world and been retold and gone into Chinese whispers. We're actually being told the same process, but with different metaphor. The metaphor of a something on a chain above the waters, the metaphor of a hawk hovering. The ruach does something called merahefet, which means hovers like a hawk. This is in Genesis. And it seems to me our ancestors remember what was seen and then find a way of telling the story. And it's the same when it comes to the genetic modification of human beings. There seems to be a memory of a mixing of substances to alter the kind of human that's already been created. And it's almost like the memory of a lab that some poor primate has of seeing the experiments that resulted in us. And that visual memory has been passed down. And really, the hair stand up on the back of your neck when you put these texts alongside each other and realize we're being told what was seen by our distant ancestors.
So amazing. You have a quote in your book. It's from Richard Dolan. It says, "The hybridization program, the program to extract genetic material from us, I think is probably very widespread. That could mean a lot of people contributing to the program." So what's your take on that? Because, you know, he's saying that it's happening now and it's really widespread. Do you think there's been multiple hybridization programs and it's just been going on forever?
Yes. And it took me by surprise as I got into the research for the Scars of Eden, how widespread this knowledge has been and how ancient it is. When I wrote Escaping from Eden, I knew it would be confronting for a lot of people, especially people of faith. The subtitle, "Does Genesis Teach That the Human Race Was Created by God or Engineered by ETs?" Could put some people off, frighten them a bit. And I realized I needed to sit down with my parents-in-law to let them know what this book was before it came out, because they're devout Christians.
Yeah.
They are from Ghana. They have a background in Baptist and Pentecostal Christianity. And I'm their son-in-law, so I'd better prepare them for the moment. So they came and visited us in Canberra, and we spent a lovely weekend, had some lovely food, some lovely wine. And when everyone was relaxed, I thought, okay, this is the moment I can tell them. So I told them what we've been talking about. This is in the book that's coming out, and I believe it's all in the Bible, and it's all hidden in plain sight there. I had no idea how they'd take it. They listened in absolute silence, poker faces. So I really didn't think it was going to happen. When I finished, my father-in-law, Kofi, leant back in his chair and he said, "Paul, a penny has dropped." Because all those things that hadn't made sense before suddenly made sense. All these anomalies he had noticed as well. And then my mother-in-law, Patience, leant forward and said, "Paul, we already know this story. In Ghana, people know that there is another presence on planet Earth that has been involved in our story as a species. And in fact, we are very close to another family whose daughter was taken for 3 years by this other demographic. We call them the Mamiwata people. It's a new name, but it's a very ancient tradition, and they told me the story of this friend of the family who went missing for 3 years, and she disappeared from the beach in Anloga in Ghana. And 3 years later, she reappeared. She found her way home. The family, of course, are absolutely thrilled. Couldn't believe she was back, did everything to help her settle and recover and move on with her life. And they were thinking the story they were going to hear was of a failed elopement or a kidnapping or slave or sex trafficking. That was what they thought must have happened. And it took quite a while before she told her parents. She said, the reason I wasn't able to get in contact is I was held in an underwater base with no devices to contact you. I was made to have children. I was there for 3 years. I'm not quite sure how I got back. But the worst thing of all is that the people who held me were not human. They were Mami Water. And when she said Mami Water, they knew what she was talking about. They knew the mythologies. They had never expected to hear this from a family member. But this experience has been relayed for hundreds, maybe thousands of years. And when I heard that story, I embarked on a journey of research around the world, and I discovered not only is it on the west coast of Africa, it's there on the east coast of Africa as well. You can go to Nigeria, Kenya, the Luo people have a story that's 500 years old that tells the same story. Go to the southern cone of South Africa, and if you are a member of one of the indigenous tribes there, you will be told all this at initiation, our place on the planet, and these other entities that live on our planet and hybridize with us. That for some reason, these other species want to improve their own species by getting some of our DNA into their gene pool. That story repeats all up the western seaboard of Africa into the Caribbean, Brazil, Haiti, Cuba, as far north as Alaska, as far east as the Philippines. In the Philippines, they have vocabulary in their language that exists only to tell this story. Those words have their roots in India. So you wonder if there's an awareness in India as well, where there are stories of hybridization in their ancestral narratives. Of course, it's in the Nordic stories. It's in Europe. I discovered when I went to Greece, the whole of Europe is named after an ET abductee or an abductee who's been used for hybridization. Europa was the daughter of a king of Phoenicia. She was abducted by a being called Zeus. She produced three hybrid children by him. One of them was Minos, the progenitor of the Minoan culture, an ancient, advanced seafaring culture. Now, I learned all this from a tour guide in Greece who reported this as history. And indeed, in Greece, this is taught as history.
Yeah.
It's not myth. It's not fable. This is the history of Europe. You can then go into the Celtic countries, as you mentioned, Neil, and the Irish, the Scots, the Welsh all have, I was going to say versions of the story, same in every single point. Mm-hmm. Underwater bases, taken for a period, used for hybridization, then returned, but the other species retains the offspring. And there's a famous scholar, Robert Kirk, who went to Scotland as a Presbyterian minister, went to the parish of Aberfoyle, and he started listening to what the locals had to tell him. And he believed, as a consequence of that listening, that that presence was still real and active when he wrote his book in 1600, and he published it. Now, Neil, you might know Presbyterian Christianity is very, very conservative. Mm-hmm. So for a Presbyterian minister to put out a book saying there is another presence on planet Earth that's hybridizing with us, that is affecting abductions and seems to have a hand in human affairs, that's not a source you'd expect to hear that from. But by the time I got to Aberfoyle in Scotland, I realized this story is all around the world. It's ages old. And yet, in the 21st century, when people come forward, I remember hearing a lady called Jane Pooley, who came on national television in Australia, And she shocked everybody by saying, I have been abducted by ETs. I've been used for hybridization. I have two hybrid children. And now that my kids are old enough to cope with everyone thinking their mum is crazy, I want to acknowledge the experience publicly and acknowledge the truth of these hybrid children publicly. Now, when people hear that today, most people will react as if they've never heard the like before. But in my research for the Scars of Eden, I realize all around the world, our ancestors have been telling us that story for thousands of years. So when will we give it an open ear? And somehow it's easier to listen to the ancient stories and ask, might that be true, than to listen to experiences today and give them a bit of respect. Understanding anyone who tells that story today, they're not going to get anything from it. They're not going to get a better job. No one's going to think better of them for it. They know they're going to be ridiculed. And that's reason enough. I think we should join the dots and say, this is the same story. Let's listen with respect and then get an idea of what's going on and why.
Yeah, exactly. And we realize that there's so many more cases and situations and experiences than are we're even being told. Not only are there those that, you know, don't share the story, but there are those that are indoctrinated in different religions that kind of look at it from a different view and don't think of it as ET. Like, for example, I know individuals that have had reptilian-like experiences and thought that they were demonic, you know? And yeah, even though it may not have actually been, that might have been a benevolent experience. So it's like it's happening much more.
Yeah. Because it's true. Of this,
go ahead.
And that's true all around the world. In Kenya, if you get returned by the Mahurani, you know, 3 years after you were taken for hybridization, and you say, well, I lived among the Mahurani for 3 years, actually, they're quite nice. You know, the chances are you are going to be taken to the church to have a demon removed from you or sent to the psychiatrist to be counseled out of your story. We don't take it seriously. And yet it is such a consistent and ancient story.
Definitely. So you're talking about Greek, right? Just recently, actually, I was doing some research on hybridization and I was doing a presentation on origin stories. And I looked into the Greek one and I read it and I was like, whoa, this is just a smoking gun hybridization story here. And then through my research, I realized that all the Indian gods have counterparts in Greece, that Indra is Zeus. Basically checklist. I went through around 50 deities and checked them all off, right? So it's pretty much the same, except maybe after they split off, they had different mythology that came from it. But you're saying that even in the India text, they talk about hybridization. It might be a little bit more to research and find out than the Greek text. But the fact that they're the same gods and have the same stories and backstory show you that it probably is, you know, the same hybridization story that they're talking about.
I agree. And I think what might be helpful for some people is to realize that these same stories exist both in religious texts and non-religious texts. So, you know, the Sumerian texts that talk about hybridization, there's no religion based on those texts.
Yeah.
Or the Greek stories, there's no religion based on those texts. And you could say the same probably of the Norse stories as well. And so then to find not only is there no religious reason behind telling those stories, but that they repeat in texts that have been regarded as religious texts, that makes you do a double take and think, okay, I need to start from scratch again.
Yeah. How many times does it need to be said before we start thinking like, hey, what's going on here? You know?
Yeah, something's going on.
Well, I really love your book because I think it's for everyone, that it's not just for people that are maybe in the know, but want to learn more, you know, like, because there's so many stories in there and so many eyewitness testimonies in there. But it's also for someone who probably doesn't know anything about it and was like, just picks up the book, or their son was like, mom, please read this. And then they can actually quantify and be like, wait a second, so many people having these experiences. Oh, wait a second, that makes sense about the Bible connection. So I'm curious, were there any testimonies and experiences that you researched that stood out to you? Do you want to maybe share a couple of those?
Yes, and you're absolutely right. The Scars of Eden is a book I hope you could give to absolutely anybody. Someone with zero interest in the topic, gives it zero credibility. But The Scars of Eden will be readable, and they'll realize there's something really interesting here for me to give my attention to. I've got a few testimonies in it, experiences, stories. I think what I'd like to say is, you know, there are dramatic stories and then there are really undramatic stories. You know, a dramatic story like Whitney Strieber's or like Jane Pooley, as I mentioned just now, the registered nurse who says she's got two hybrid children, that you, if only to read about the Westall encounter in Melbourne in 1966, a mass UFO sighting that's been hushed up to this very day. Read The Scars of Eden for that. But my goal really in The Scars of Eden is to get people talking and sharing their own experiences. And so I talk a little bit about my own experiences that are not dramatic. Mm-hmm. They're really vague and half remembered. And so I talk about something that happened to me when I was 20, where I encountered some beings that I thought were demonic beings, and now I realize they can't have been. And I remember how it began. I don't remember what happened next. It's really vague. And then I had an experience where I was in a shop in Chichester again when I was 20, and I saw some people who I, within 5 minutes, was thinking they're not human. Why did I think that? Well, my reasons were really vague and subjective and doesn't prove anything, but it was an encounter that I had when I was 20. And all these years later, I can't forget what it felt like observing these two people moving around this shop. What was that about? I also share an experience of missing time. And I want to encourage people, if you've got a friendship circle or a family circle anywhere, if you sit it down and ask the people, have you ever experienced something you couldn't explain? Something that happened you've been puzzled about ever since? I reckon you wouldn't find a friendship circle or a family circle anywhere that wouldn't have at least one story. And if we can listen to each other's stories like that, we will begin to realize these stories go together. They begin to confirm for us that we're not alone on this planet or in this corner of the cosmos. And I think if we could do that, just take the ridicule factor away, listen seriously with respect to each other for our anomalous stories, we would all have a story about another presence on planet Earth that points to the probability of ET contact.
Mm, yep. Especially if you are talking about the abduction phenomena and believe that that certain beings actually abduct people from the same family, generations.
You know, yes. Yeah, they do. That's exactly right. Mm-hmm. And that's true today, just as it was in ancient texts. Mm-hmm. Families will be followed. So very often I have people contacting me who've read Escaping from Eden, or they watch The Fifth Kind TV, and they will share their experience very tentatively. You know, sometimes people share with me things that happened when they were 15 years old, and they're telling me now they're 65. And they will say, I have told my wife, I talked with the person I was with at the time, and I haven't told another living, breathing soul in the 50 years since. But I'm telling you because I still don't understand it. I still need to process it. So they'll tell me a story like this. They'll tell me a story of repeated contact. They'll tell me a story about their consciousness being altered or affected by it, or their health altered or affected by it. And they've been isolated by the story because they've had no one to talk to about it. And then I might say, have your parents experienced anything like this? Oh, not to my knowledge, they'll say. And then a week later, I'll get an email. I talked to my dad and he told me what happened to him when he was 15. And bit by bit, you realize, yes, actually, if you've had an encounter, chances are it goes through your family and they're observing your family and learning from your family. And that's a story that's as old as the hills. And again, this is why I wish we were taught, because these experiences are isolating. I talked to an Argentinian farmer, Juan Perez, who lived in isolation for 45 years because he couldn't cope with the ridicule and hatred that was visited upon him because he had a close encounter that affected him profoundly. And he was in his 40s before his mum said, actually, Han, I should tell you about my experiences. And he'd been so isolated, and I think he could have been so much more helped if the family had come forward and said, yes, this is part of what we experience as a family.
Right, right. That's so interesting. Go ahead, go, keep going.
I know other families who, I think of a Cherokee family I've had contact with in Australia, where they have been visited for generations by beings they believe are from the Pleiades, and it hasn't been disturbing. It hasn't been isolating, because nothing bad has happened, and they have talked to each other about it. Right. And so the guy I met, his dad sat him down when he was about 20 years old and said, I need to tell you about our history as a people, where we came from, who nurtured our civilization, and how I got healed when I was, I think he was 12 years old. He was, he was given about 12 months to live. And then he had a close encounter that completely healed him. And now he's telling his son. So there's a family that has no fear of these contacts, because for them, at least, nothing bad has happened, and the contact is ages old. That's not everybody's story. There's a spectrum of ET demographics around us, a spectrum of experiences of abduction and hybridization, some deeply traumatizing. My friend G.L. Davies has written a book, Harvest, which is really at the very dark and disturbing end of the spectrum. And then my friend Barbara Lamb has counseled more than 2,000 people with these kind of experiences, and many of them report them as positive experiences.
Yeah.
So there really is a great spectrum of things happening around us.
Yeah, exactly. And Barbara Lamb did a few presentations on the spirituality of ETs, because she does connect with that a lot and really connects with the benevolent ones. Now, my question is to you, what is, in your opinion, the Garden of Eden?
Well, I titled my first book Escaping from Eden because the impression I formed through my retranslation work was that Eden wasn't a paradise, that the way it's told in the Hebrew version of the story, Eden was an enclosed zone where our ancestors were engineered and provided for. And once it was decided that we could no longer be managed because one of the genetic engineers had broken rank and upgraded us to make us too smart to be managed, we were thrown out of the enclosed zone into a world with other animals, other primates, other human-like beings. And so that's the picture I have. And there are some interesting little clues in the Genesis version of the story that Eden wasn't this idyllic garden. And there's a little verse that says that the powerful ones put the humans to work. What work? Well, a few verses prior, we're told about some key mineral deposits not far from Eden. And so I join the dots and think this is an allusion to the Sumerian story of our ancestors being used as a workforce in mines, mining for minerals for those who came and colonized us.
Okay, beautiful. Thank you for sharing that. So I have one last question. We have a few more minutes left. And this question is kind of, it's good to be at the end because it really is what happened after the ET overlords left is my question really. Because you did say that in your book, you said, you know, we've shifted from ridiculing the subject to being serious about it. And then also with ET overlords, it seems that they handed it over to the humans basically to take over. So did they leave and did a human bloodline take over, or is this bloodline maybe connected to the original overlords and that have been, you know, attempting to rule us for thousands of years? What's your thoughts on that?
Yes, I think all of the above. It's interesting that the Sumerian and the Greek and the biblical stories all have handover stories where we begin with these ET overlords, as you call them, governing us, and then they hand over to human successors. And so Gilgamesh is that crossover king. He's a hybrid of sky people plus human. In the Hebrew story, Saul is the first human king, and that transition is very unpleasant. But what's interesting is that many of the dynamics that were set up in the beginning when our overlords were not human persist to this day. And the kind of wars that we're seeing today, I mean, literal international wars, but also education wars, health wars, farming wars. I think these conflicts were framed back in the time of ET interventions, different ET cultures coming in. And the two models of farming, for instance, that are clashing right now, the industrial scale GM petrochemical model of farming versus the traditional rotational organic combination farming. These are clashing on our planet right now. And I think those two models of farming have their roots in ET intervention. So even with right. the ET overlords gone, those conflicts persist. Mm-hmm. I would be among many who would have a question mark as to what strings are still being pulled by a non-human layer in human governance. And I think they're very much in the mix. When Hayim Eshed, the former head of Israel's space security program, talks about an intergalactic federation that's chosen not to self-disclose, that's the picture that our ancestors painted. And it means they're present, they've got strings to pull, but they're just not doing it publicly.
Right, right. It's almost like an imprint was created on Earth, and we're experiencing that collective cellular trauma and attempting to shake it out of our bodies somehow, you know?
Absolutely. And I hope that the Scars of Eden, events like this, your work, Neil, and those of all the speakers at Forgery Unmasked, really we're making our own contribution to try and shake us all free from that mentality. A whole model of leadership was forged in that time when we were ruled over by ETs. All sorts of thinking and hardwiring where we, you know, serve our superiors. We've got to undo it, unravel it, get ourselves more conscious of who we really are, what our potential really is as a species. And I'm really excited by the fact that many of these ancient cultures who curated these stories of origins also curated methods to upgrade our consciousness. Yeah. Where Sol Rita mentioned control conscious breathing. I find that incredibly powerful for consciousness. Mm. Also, what we eat and drink has an impact on it. Plato's method was kaikion, which was a psychoeffective tea, and there are psychoeffective teas you can drink today. All these things come together to help us shake this legacy off and live a more alive, happier, more fulfilled life, fulfilling more of our potential and enjoying what we really can be as human beings.
Yeah, I agree 100%. One more question based on that, because I'm actually extremely impressed with the fact that I asked you every question I have on my list. This is this is the last question. I literally asked you everything. Okay, this is the last one. So you said that there's a transfer of power from Yahweh to the people of Israel, Israel's first human king, right? You said it was an ugly mess. Are you talking about Jericho right there? And they when they went and they got the promised land, and you know Moses couldn't go over there.
No, this comes a little bit later than that, and they've been governed by this entity Yahweh. And again, I draw a distinction between that entity and any God concept. The active character Yahweh is an ET. He is an Elohim. He's governed over this particular people group, and he's not very nice. He really is not. He's a very mercurial, violent character. And so, surprise, surprise, it reaches the point where the people have had enough. And they say, okay, thank you for your services. We would like a human king now, like some of the other peoples around here have. Mm-hmm. And he is so offended by this, he appoints a human king, King Saul, and then he sabotages him. He torments him, drives him insane to the point where he commits suicide, crowns a new king while he's still supposedly reigning because Saul won't do genocide the way Yahweh does genocide. Mm. Saul thought he was doing the right thing. He didn't do scorched earth. He brought some stuff back with him. He killed the leaders, but saved the king and some of the people. And because it wasn't total genocide, Yahweh sabotages him. So that's a really odd story. And it's one of those anomalies that if you're a preacher, there's no, what positive moral of the story can you possibly draw from that? And so that's an unhappy transition, but it is moving us into the time where we have humans governing over humans. And I hope that's just a transitional step to a society where we actually look after and serve one another.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. Paul, brother, it's been so incredible talking to you. Thank you for everything you do. Thank you for writing these books and, you know, the wealth of knowledge that you share. I appreciate you so much. And if you would like to just say a few last words and maybe share where people can find out more about you and your book, how they can pre-order it on Amazon.
Yes, you can follow me on my website, paulanthonywallace.com, Anthony with an H, Wallace, W-A-L-L-I-S, paulanthonywallace.com. You can keep up with everything I'm doing there. I co-host The Fifth Kind TV with Anthony Barrett. You can find us on YouTube. You can find us at fifthkind.tv. I have my own channel as well, the Paul Wallace channel. And if you go to Amazon, Kindle, Barnes & Noble, you'll find The Scars of Eden and Escaping from Eden. And they are gateway books. They're books you could give to absolutely anybody in either order, and it will take them into this territory and get them fascinated by it.
Mm-hmm, I agree. And I read half of it, and I'm going to read it. I don't, to be honest, I don't read a lot. I like to watch videos. So, but I read it, and it's such an easy read. It's such an easy read as well. Like, I really went through it really quickly. I was reading it just today, so I highly recommend it to everyone. Paul, it's been great talking to you, brother. I think you're going to be here for the panel.
Mm-hmm. I am. Neil, thanks so much. I've really enjoyed talking to you today, and I loved your material today.
Thank you, brother. I hope to connect with you more. I definitely want to have you on our platform too, so we'll talk in the future.
All right.